From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in August at a concert at Radio City Music Hall. It was legendary singer Tony Bennett's 95th birthday, and he was set to perform with Lady Gaga. The concert, which will be broadcast later this fall, is significant. Bennett received no fewer than 20 standing ovations as he sang hit after hit from the Great American Songbook. It will likely be his final live performance, and his family told Anderson Cooper in a special for 60 Minutes that as well as it went, he now has no recollection of it. Tony Bennett has Alzheimer's disease. His wife Susan says he first grew concerned about his memory 5 years ago when he struggled to remember the names of his musicians. Now he recognizes Susan and his children, but most of the time he doesn't remember much. Susan says he doesn't really know that he has the disease. In the 60-minute special, she and Anderson Cooper help Tony answer questions about his life and career. He sits quietly for most of the discussions, but that all changes when it is time to sing, whether in his home with his accompanist or on stage with Lady Gaga. Tony Bennett transforms when he performs. His doctor explains that people with Alzheimer's respond to their strengths, and for Tony, being a performer is an innate and hardwired part of his brain now. He may not know what day it is or where his apartment is located, but music engages his brain in a way that lights him up. And Tony Bennett is, of course, one of millions of Americans with Alzheimer's disease. According to the Alzheimer's Association, by the year 2050, the number of people aged 65 and older with Alzheimer's is projected to reach 12.7 million. So what do families need to know about the diagnosis and the treatment of the disease? And how can caregivers help patients now? Our guests this hour discuss the latest in Alzheimer's research, and we hear personal experiences with the disease. And I'd like to welcome our guests here. Teresa Galbier is chapter executive for the Rochester and Finger Lakes chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Welcome back. Thanks for being here. Also welcome to Maureen McGuire, chair of the Rochester's Walk to End Alzheimer's, whose father passed away from Alzheimer's disease in 2016. And of course, we know Maureen, longtime great journalist, and it's nice to see you here in studio.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Evan.
And let me welcome Dr. Anton Thorstensen, who's director of the University of Rochester Alzheimer's Disease Care Research and Education Program, and William B. and Sheila Konar, professor of psychiatry in the University of Rochester, the School of Medicine and Dentistry. Dr. Thorstensen, thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Before the program even began, we were just talking a little bit about Tony Bennett. And Teresa, you were saying that not only did that piece move you, but you had a little bit of the association had a little bit of a connection to it.
Yes, our Alzheimer's Association National Office has an incredible communications team, and they've actually been working with Tony and his wife for quite a while prior to his public announcement of having Alzheimer's disease, and throughout the production of that 60-minute segment, they helped to, you know, craft language that was appropriate, that would be inclusive of the language that goes with the disease, and supporting Tony and his wife through that journey and through the interview process. So we're very proud that Tony Bennett has been a partner of the Alzheimer's Association and has so courageously and bravely stepped forward to let the world know about his situation.
Let's listen to a little bit of that clip. We grabbed a little bit of the 60 Minutes, and this is from 60 Minutes Overtime, some of the extra footage and storytelling that Anderson Cooper and the team put together. So you're going to hear Anderson Cooper. You'll hear the great voice of Tony Bennett, who in his 90s just still doing it. And then some of the impact of the power of the music. Let's listen.
But when it was time to rehearse, something incredible happened. Tony's accompanist, Lee Musiker, began playing, and suddenly the legendary showman was back.
Let someone stop believing in you. Let him hold out his hand. Let him find you and watch what happens. Smile though your heart is aching. Smile even though it's breaking.
He had no notes, no cue cards.
When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by.
We were amazed. All his old songs were somehow still there. He sang an hour-long set from memory.
If you just smile.
Bravo, Tony.
Thank you.
That was incredible. You just start playing something and it's all there?
When I start playing, Tony is completely engaged, and this is a whole new performance, and new phrases, new nuance, nothing short of a miracle.
Dr. Gayatri Devi explained how a transformation like that was possible.
People respond differently depending on their strengths. In Tony's case, it's his musical memory, his ability to be a performer. Those are an innate and hardwired part of his brain. So even though he doesn't know what the day might be or where his apartment is, he still can sing the whole repertoire of the American Songbook and move people.
The voice itself, Teresa, I mean, amazing how much he sounds like the Tony Bennett we've always known, doesn't he?
He is the Tony Bennett we've always known, Evan. And, you know, the Alzheimer's Association recognized the benefits of these types of therapies, music therapy, occupational therapy, art therapy, and things like that many, many years ago. We've built an entire enrichment division because of that. And it's about the brain science. It's not just something entertaining that feels good. It's actually impacting his brain and his capacity to dig deep into places where he had that stored and to release it. And there's definitely a lingering effect. We don't necessarily know what that is, but that gives him an incredibly enriched quality of life for a period of time after he performs.
Maureen McGuire, you're one of the best storytellers I know. And I thought the storytelling in this piece was not just powerful, but it refused to be sort of maudlin or overly exploitative. It was direct about what he has gone through. But the power in it was just in the simplicity and in seeing and hearing him. I thought it was very tasteful. I wonder what you thought.
Same here. You know, for me, I don't think you necessarily have to have a loved one who has had Alzheimer's or has Alzheimer's now to have been really impacted emotionally by that piece. It really reached everybody. It's such a tough disease. And when I was watching it, I recognized my own father in terms of the affect, kind of the flat affect that Tony had when they would ask him questions, or the care with which Lady Gaga in this piece was asking him about what songs he'd like to play. You know, there was obviously people around him were very in tune, but his responses, it was tough to watch. But at the same time, it was so beautiful. This was a hopeful piece because you knew, number one, that he was surrounded by so much support. He had so much support. You felt the love, and that what was happening was based on science. Mm. You know, people have answers for why he was able, Teresa just explained, why he was able to access this part of his brain that allowed him to thrive in those moments. And for me, it wasn't a sad piece, even though I felt very moved throughout. It was a hopeful piece.
Yeah. Dr. Thorstensen, how did you take it?
The same way. This was very, very impactful. And it actually, I've seen this with my patients through the years that they can tap into old memories and old skills, things that are hardwired into their brains and maybe stored in parts of the brain that are not so affected by the Alzheimer's pathology. And, you know, you see people light up, the sense of achievement, the sense of mastery that they can do something that they enjoy so much. And with Tony Bennett, and I actually have to reflect also back on other musicians and entertainers that were able to do the same, like Glenn Campbell. And it's amazing to see when people can just suddenly come alive.
Listeners, if you've got thoughts, comments, stories to share, you can do that several ways this hour. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. The Walk to End Alzheimer's is tomorrow, right across from us here at Frontier Field. Registration starts at 9. The walk begins at 10 o'clock. And we'll put links online, more information. And Maureen is the chair of the Rochester Walk. We'll talk more about the event coming up here. You referenced your own dad.
Yeah.
And let me just start by asking you to first share us, what is the first memory that comes to mind of your dad now, five years after his passing, roughly? Is that right?
Yeah,
five years. What comes to mind for you first when you think of dad?
You know, I think about the early days, mm-hmm. the diagnosis. I was thinking about that a lot as I was driving here today to the studio, and how frightening it was, and how he handled it with such dignity as he told one by one all of his children. It made sense. I thought about how much of it made sense when I looked back at the previous months and what had been going on with him. He handled it with such dignity. He was scared. There was no question he was scared. But he was just determined to move forward. And I'm so glad, by the way, that Dr. Thorstensen is on with us today because Anton was my dad's doctor. And he was beautiful. They had a beautiful relationship throughout the 6 years that he lived with this disease.
When you mentioned watching the 60 Minutes piece on Tony Bennett and the recognition you had in some of what you described, I think accurately, as a little bit of a flat affect.
Yeah.
You know, they're talking to Tony Bennett and they're asking questions, and a lot of the questions are met with sort of one word answers. Mm-hmm. Not a whole, unfortunately, didn't even remember the performing at Radio City. Of course, he's on stage. He was remarkable, but yeah. Days later, didn't remember. Take me through what you experienced and maybe what the timeline was with your dad. And then we'll talk about how you worked to best kind of cope with that, help him cope with that. And I think Dr. Thorstensen will help us as well.
Well, you know, in the months leading up to the diagnosis, I personally thought my dad might be depressed, or maybe he was hard of hearing. I mean, you know, he wore hearing aids, you know, at that point in life when everybody's starting to wear hearing aids, but he wore them, and I thought maybe they're not working very mm-hmm. well. He wasn't as talkative. I used to love to scoot over to their house, and he'd always corral me into a nickel game of gin rummy, you know, or a little poker, and he would end these games early. You know, he'd put the cards down.
I was out of character for him.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were renovating their home, and I scooted over there, and one of the contractors took me aside and said, "Look, your father wants to know about this and that and this, but I don't understand what he's talking about." Mm. And it was alarming to me. We traveled to Ireland. And he got lost in the hotel. And then finally, he got lost driving. He made his way home, but we were 2 seconds away from calling the police. I had gone out looking for him. I was at work. And my mother, he was supposed to pick my mother up from some event, and he never showed up. So she got a ride home and waited. She called me. I got in the, you know, car and
it had to be
looking.
A very hard moment.
Yeah, and after that, you know, he was diagnosed. Within a month, he had a diagnosis. And you know, I feel very blessed that over the course of his disease, he was very, the first couple of years, he was very engaged. We kept him busy mm-hmm. With the support of the Alzheimer's Association. We learned a lot about caregiving and to take breaks and to lean on others and to use respite services. But that was later. The progression, it's relentless. And by the end, you know, he was really struggling with his language, but he always knew who we were. He always said, I love you, always. And so I feel that we were really blessed. And I miss him. I hate this disease, too.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't like it either, I'll tell you. So he participated in local research, which is great.
Let me ask you about some of the questions that maybe would come to mind for me, not having been in a position that you were in with a parent or direct family member as yet. I mean, there's been Alzheimer's, many of our family, I'm sure Teresa has got stats, and I don't know anybody who hasn't been touched by it in some way, but I haven't been in a direct situation as you were. So the questions that maybe come to mind first for me are, how fast is this going to move? Can we slow this? I mean, is there a way to mitigate? Are there medicines? Are there right and wrong things to do or say or work through this? Those are the things that kind of, what were the questions that you had after that initial diagnosis, which, as you say, if there was any relief at all, it was at least understanding what was happening. But then you get maybe a very gripping scenario in which you're confronting it in a very real way.
You know, honestly, what cut through all any of the emotion in terms of we didn't worry so much about handling the disease. But what I worried initially about was finances. Isn't that funny? Literally, it was okay. We were going to the doctors. Okay, yeah. here's going to be your regimen of pills. Okay, and you know, but for my family, we scrambled right away, and we worked with we ended up working with an attorney and who specializes in elder care. We used guidelines from the Alzheimer's Association actually, and just to develop a plan so that we didn't have to worry about that stuff. You know, what's our plan for long term care? Should it come to that? I didn't know my dad, I knew my dad would not be able to handle finances eventually. So I had to figure out what it was. I didn't know how they handled their own finances. So that took 6 to 7 months. But once that was in place, we were free. We were free to enjoy each other. We were free to handle the challenges as they came up. It was just one less stressor. And I would suggest for a lot of families, this is just something to handle early so that you don't have to worry about it. Because it's a tough disease, you know.
Teresa, you're nodding along with this, and I know there's a lot of recognition in Maureen's story because it's reflected in so many stories you hear, isn't it?
It is. You know, the early warning signs that Maureen talked about, those are so common. That's when families will tend to call us. One of the most common triggers is my mom drove somewhere and got lost, or she didn't show up to pick me up, or my dad.
Exactly what happened with her dad. Yeah.
That's a common trigger. Another common trigger is if they typically are doing the finances for the household and they're spending money. Nobody can figure out where, or talking to contractors and having them do outrageous things and just making very difficult financial decisions that don't make sense in the history of that person. And so we always go back and say, if that person used to be able to balance their checkbook every Friday and they just can't even figure it out anymore, that's a trigger for something. So we do have early warning signs we talk about. What I'm so impressed with Maureen and her family is they took such a healthy approach. They did what they could control. They made very informed, educated decisions about her father's financial situation, the legal implications, the planning, allowing him to be able to choose when he isn't going to be able to choose anymore where he will reside or not. And it's so important to include the person with dementia, if they're capable of that, in the early stages to talk about it so that when the family makes the most painful, difficult decisions they will ever make in their lives, they will have to make those on their own. And if they can honor the choices that their loved one had wanted them to honor in the beginning, it relieves a lot of that sense of anxiety, the guilt that comes later on in the journey. And we can help families walk through that process. We have an early stage engagement program. We have early stage series. It's all educational for families who are on that front end. And the person with dementia and their care partner, whoever it is identified to be, walks through that journey through this curriculum-based program, and they can help each other make those informed decisions. And then the care partner can also talk about how painful and difficult this journey is for them, and they can do it in the confines of a very sensitive, confidential setting. Because we care deeply, deeply about the person who's impacted by Alzheimer's, but we also care as deeply about the people that are going to walk the journey with them. And it really is a caregiving journey. And it can be very painful and difficult, but it also can be very meaningful, very fun, very exciting when you can plan thoughtfully and be informed about what this is going to look like and feel like. You know, I think of Dr. Thorstensen and how he walks our families through this journey, and he helps them to understand the disease process, but also how to live a good life. We talk about living your good life with dementia, and it's a partnership between the doctors, between the family, between the person living with the disease, and between the supports that are out in the community. The Alzheimer's Association has a wonderful partnership with Lifespan of Greater Rochester. We run something called the Finger Lakes Alzheimer's Caregiver Institute, and that is, it's the name says it all. It is a program that helps the caregiver through the journey. And there are so many rich services in this community. If people will just contact us, we can help connect them to those services. They don't have to go it alone, Evan.
How do they contact you?
1-800-272-3900, or they can go on our website, alz.org.
Dr. Thorstensen, on that the question of process and what to expect, has that changed over time in any way? In other words, are there therapies, mitigation strategies that have allowed the progression of the disease to slow? I mean, can you take us through where we are in the approach and whether that's changing? I'm sorry, doctor. I couldn't hear you for a second. Go ahead.
Not a problem. I think that we have to admit that progress has been made, and yet progress has been slow. There are a few important things. I've been in this field for so long, I sometimes say it was in the last millennia that I started. But there's much greater awareness of Alzheimer's disease. There's much greater awareness of the early symptoms, and people are coming in earlier. Nevertheless, this is a disease that starts taking hold in your brain maybe 20, 25, even 30 years before you have the first symptoms. So it's basically taking hold. It's creating an extensive amount of damage. And the brain is such a resilient organ that we have to suffer a significant loss of neurons before symptoms start to emerge. And the better that we can live a brain-healthy lifestyle, the better we build up our reserve. There are clearly things that we can do through our lifetime that will bend the curve. And that includes regular exercise, cognitive engagement, so keep your mind active. Don't get stuck in the same rut. Try to learn and master new skills. Be thoughtful about your diet and thoughtful about kind of social engagement. Don't drink too much. Don't smoke too much. Don't eat too much fat and red meat. So many of the things that we hear regularly contributes to a successful aging matters for Alzheimer's disease as well. So there are things that we can do, and it's almost never too late. Even for people that start showing symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, they can do things to bend the curve. At the same time, I think that it's very important to understand that this is a progressive disease, and there's nothing that we have right now that stops that stops the disease in its track. We are working on it, and I think that what will become more and more important is to identify the disease at a much earlier stage than we have historically done. And that's a very significant focus of research right now. And because we have to intervene before there is irreversible damage that has happened to the brain.
Before I go to our only break of the hour, let me just ask Maureen McGuire to remind you what's coming up tomorrow.
We have the Walk to End Alzheimer's. It's our biggest fundraiser for the local chapter. It takes place tomorrow morning at Frontier Field. And it's our opportunity to be together and support one another and raise money for this great organization.
Register in advance?
You know, most people who are already raising money are registered, so that's great. They can show, we've done this COVID protocol, so they can show up and just begin walking if they need to. But you can also show up at the gate 9 a.m. We'll be open and ready to take you and walking at 10 a.m.
Walking at 10 a.m. right down here at Frontier Field for the Walk to End Alzheimer's. Maureen McGuire is the chair, and also talking about her own family's experience with Alzheimer's. Teresa Galbier is chapter executive for the Rochester and Finger Lakes chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. And Dr. Anton Thorstensen is here from the University of Rochester's Alzheimer's Disease Care Research and Education Program and was Maureen's dad's doctor. And you can hear the affection that she has, and I'm sure her whole family does. Let's take this only break of the hour, and we're right back with some of your feedback and questions for the team. Coming up in our second hour, science writer Shannon Sterone joins us. She just had a cover story on Esquire about our alien obsession and how we are often thinking about space, but probably doing it wrong. Whether it's our thoughts about UFOs or even the space race among the billionaire class, Shannon Sterone says there should be a different way to think about space and to think about ourselves. And we'll do that next hour. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections. And during our brief break, Teresa Galbier from the Alzheimer's Association was just mentioning just how real and significant these numbers are. You just heard Dr. Thorstensen, Teresa, mention that realistically right now, we're better at dealing with this. We're better at diagnosing it, but we can't stop Alzheimer's. Maybe someday, but not right now. And the reality of the numbers is tough to hear, but let's hear it. Where are we at in terms of how many Americans, how many New Yorkers, and where do we think we're going?
We have 6.2 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's today. By the middle of this century, that is going to exponentially rise to more than 11 million without a cure or prevention. And so that's important to note, because that trajectory can totally change. If now that we do have some treatments for this year for the first time, there's actually a treatment that is helping to reduce the risk for those in the early stages. But if without that, we are going to keep seeing this exponential growth. In New York State, 410,000 New Yorkers are living with Alzheimer's today. And just in the next 4 years, it's going to balloon up to 460,000 New Yorkers.
Dr. Thorstensen, can you just briefly tell us a little bit about the treatment that Teresa is referencing?
So there was a treatment approved provisionally by the Food and Drug Administration back in June. And it's the first treatment that targets the underpinning of the disease, the pathology, so the amyloid plaques that build up in the brain. This approval wasn't without controversy, and it's still being worked out. But this is the first of several medications and other interventions that are basically lining up. I think that we're at a point that the sun and the moon and the stars are kind of lining up that we will start to see accelerated traction, not only in identifying the disease early, but to deal with the Alzheimer's process that creates all this damage.
Okay, let's get some questions from the audience. Let me start in Victor on the phone. This is Keith. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
An interesting show. I got to ask the doctor an adult question. Now, there's you just mentioned a drug that looks like it might help either cure or slow down dementia. And then you earlier mentioned activities that can prevent it. And I've never heard any doctor talk about, let's be honest, sex. A good sexual relationship, even though you're older, with your significant other, wife, whatever. Is there any research, basically a question and answer, where they sit down 1,000 senior citizens, ask them all these questions, including sex being one of them, and come to some sort of a commonality between those who seem to be staving off Alzheimer's and those who have Alzheimer's?
Doctor?
So, look, there's no single thing that will prevent you from developing Alzheimer's disease if that is kind of the path that life takes you. But again, we know that social engagement, close relationships with your loved ones, and matter in terms of delaying the onset of the disease. And I totally agree that a healthy relationship between couples in most instances involves intimacy, and sex would be part of the intimacy quotients for couples. So have we focused singularly on the importance of sexual relations? No, but as part of this overall kind of healthy social engagement, healthy connections with other people, we know that those matter.
Keith, thank you. Eric writes us to say, regarding the impact of music on people like Tony Bennett, who we referenced earlier this hour, that 60 Minutes featured this week. Eric says, is this unique to music, or are other skills hardwired and impactful? Is this part of the brain more protected from dementia? So two prongs there. Dr. Thorstensen, a lot of publicity over the years about the impact of music on people with mental illness, dementia, Alzheimer's. He's wondering, can we go beyond music?
We can. There's been a lot of focus on music, and that is for a reason. I'm not a musical person, but I enjoy music. And I've seen among my patients where basically I remember the daughter of one of my patients who was a successful business executive. And she said, I never knew that Dad really enjoyed music. But as he advanced in his Alzheimer's disease, this was basically, we got together. We listened to music from his younger years, and I never knew. He knew the songs. He could sing along. And at a time where so many other memories were forgotten. So it does appear that the music is stored in a part, and musical skills, be that singing or playing musical instruments, are stored in a part of the brain that is protected to some degree. But all kinds of other skill sets that are kind of hardwired, and what I mean by that is something that you engaged with early in life and then maintained through your lifetime, or kind of reemerged later. It's quite remarkable. So the skill sets that some people have with playing cards, the skill set that people have with woodworking and tools, and maybe managing chores around and maintenance around their house. It can be quite striking. The ability for some people to cook off the top of their memory and still, create these intricate meals that have been part of a family tradition. What you need to keep in mind, though, is that people need assistance. As you saw with Tony Bennett, he had a very supportive group around him that helped him kind of tap into this. And it's the same with just the general population. If you engage someone, you help them move beyond this kind of hesitancy or reticence that we often see, the passivity, and you help them navigate through tasks by breaking them down into smaller, manageable units. It's amazing how people can find things that they can connect together with, and very often something that that they have a lifetime of connection with. So, yes, it goes beyond music.
Rachel in Canandaigua writes to say, my mother was in the Gardens AZ facility, and my dad took a tape deck there for the patients. He was in the Johnny Long Orchestra way back when and had hours of big band music that he would record and share with them. For many of the patients, hearing the music changed their level of responsiveness considerably. And Rachel goes on to say, it should be a standard treatment in any place treating people with cognition issues. Thank you for that, Rachel. Maureen, was there anything that really kind of kept your dad a little bit more connected when he was, when the progression of Alzheimer's was impacting him?
Well, for my dad, what kept him connected was family. There's no question. We all stepped up. Everybody visited all the time. As I was listening to Therese and Dr. Thorsenton talk, one of the most beautiful memories for me, looking back on the years as his disease progressed, was we'd get in the car, we'd go for a ride, and this is really up until weeks before he passed away, and we would drive through Rochester, and he could, hey, well, over there, I delivered papers, or you know, your Uncle Jerry and I rode the bus downtown. I was 6 years old, and then, and he would trace the route. He'd say, drive here, turn left. It was so detailed, and it was so fun for me to listen. And he clearly enjoyed being able to talk about these memories. Because an hour later, you'd be in a restaurant, and he was back to the flat affect, the connection part of this is really what's moving me just listening to, because I look back and see, wow, we were really, really blessed, because intuitively we knew that what's helping everybody through this, not just my dad, but my mom and my siblings and my nieces and my nephews and, you know, the great-grandchildren in this mix, was the connection to one another. Mm-hmm. It helped.
Well, let me get back to your phone calls. This is Ann and that's the wrong one. That's a user error here. That wasn't an engineering issue, I just want to say. That was a user error. That was me. Ann in Penfield. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. This is a wonderful, wonderful program. And I wondered if you could ask your guests to comment on some of the surprising causes of dementia-like symptoms that people might not be aware of. I'm thinking in particular of sleep apnea, with key to that might be if somebody's snoring a lot. That may be an indication of that. And sleep apnea itself can cause an elevated blood pressure, which in turn can kick off TIAs, transient ischemic attacks, the little mini strokes. And people can have sort of unusual memory losses and kind of surprising executive function difficulties, but then using an aid like a CPAP machines, and sometimes even there can be problems with B12 deficiency or thyroid deficiency, but in particular, I've seen some wonderful turnarounds happen when once people get on CPAP, mm-hmm. So I wondered if your guest could comment on that. And, you know, kudos to everything you are all doing. It's wonderful.
Thank you, Ann. Let me start with the doctor, and I think all of our guests may want to weigh in on aspects of this. Dr. Thorsenton, go ahead.
Absolutely. So sleep is incredibly important for your health overall, as well as your brain health. And there are a number of conditions that can impact your sleep so that your sleep isn't as restful, isn't as restorative. When you sleep, actually your brain uses the time to take up the trash. It is a unique system in the brain that we call the glymphatic system. And actually, much of that research and discovery has been at the University of Rochester. Basically, in deep, solid sleep, your brain shrinks and the spaces in between open up. So there's greater flow of the cerebrospinal fluid that then takes out the waste products. So anything that negatively impacts sleep, and one of the most common conditions are sleep apnea, which is a condition where the soft palate or your airway kind of collapses when you're in deep sleep, and you can't breathe appropriately and well enough, and therefore you have maybe hundreds of episodes overnight where you your blood oxygen drops, and you have these partial awakenings, and can be managed. It has to be assessed, but can be appropriately managed, for example, with a so-called CPAP machine that creates an airway pressure to keep your airway open. There are other things that can have a negative impact on sleep, such as restless leg syndrome and what is called REM sleep disorder, which are incredibly vivid dreams often associated with sleepwalking, that are risk factors for dementia as well. In addition to sleep, you know, depression and mood disorders can increase your risk. Certainly cardiovascular disorders or anything that reduces your brain reserves, such as mini strokes or larger strokes. She mentioned vitamin deficiencies such as B12, but also important for this area, vitamin D, because of the lack of exposure to sunlight, because we know there's a balance between not having enough sun and having too much sun, which can have a negative impact as well. But this is why when someone develops memory issues, there is the importance of careful medical evaluation and having access to skilled providers who can do an adequate evaluation of why it is that you have memory problems. And if some of the reasons for that are reversible, that they can be fixed, such as poor sleep or thyroid deficiency, vitamin B12 deficiency, et cetera, that remains critical.
Okay. Maureen McGuire, during that phone call, you were nodding a bit. Did it bring some thoughts to mind of your family?
Yeah. My dad struggled with, had sleep issues. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can't really speak with much authority about it in depth about them, but I know that he struggled with some of the symptoms that Dr. Thorstenson just mentioned, the vivid dreams, the sleep apnea. And this, you know, I think what kind of gets me is looking back and by the time he was diagnosed, that was a well-established part, a challenge for him in his life. So, you know, he did, but we addressed those things as they came up while he was living with his disease and you know, tried to mitigate some of the issues that he had with his trouble sleeping, but it was definitely an issue for him.
Okay. Anything you want to add, Teresa?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that is such an important question that your listener called in about. Not only everything that was just shared, but as we were talking earlier about the fact that there might be some wonderful treatments coming down the pike, those treatments can only be prescribed to those who have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or dementia. And so the Alzheimer's Association is such a proponent of an early and accurate diagnosis for so many reasons, but as importantly, so that that person is prepared. So if a treatment comes, then they can receive that treatment. And so we really advocate for that. As Dr. Thorstensen mentioned, there are so many potential causes for cognitive issues that could be ruled out. So perhaps we don't just assume that somebody has dementia just because they have the early warning signs. And so that diagnosis, that first line of defense, see your doctor. That is so critical.
Joel in Pittsford next on the phone. Hi, Joel. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I wanted to comment on the Dukinab. That's the drug that Teresa commented on earlier. As Dr. Thorstensen said, its approval was not without controversy. And I am a supporter. I have been a long-term supporter of the Alzheimer's Association, but I have been very disappointed with their support for this Dukinab drug. Its efficacy is at best questionable, and its approval was with a lot of controversy. At $56,000 a year, perhaps Therese could comment on why I've been receiving these beautiful notes from the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association touting Dukinab as the next miracle. And maybe Dr. Thorstensen can comment on the controversy.
Okay. Thanks very much. Teresa, let's start with that. Expensive possible treatment. Go ahead.
Absolutely. So all of the treatments that have been expensive like that for other diseases, including multiple sclerosis and others, because this is an infusion, and that's what really drives up the cost, have been eventually approved through third parties, through Medicare and other parties. And so the Alzheimer's Association position is that if the treatment has been had some efficacy, and Dr. Thorstensen actually ran a trial, so he's going to speak more specifically to that. But if there was efficacy in this trial for those in the early stages of the disease, mild cognitive impairment in early stage, so you really have to get it early on, then we celebrated this very first ever treatment for Alzheimer's disease, which is breaking new ground for other treatments to follow. You have to start somewhere. And that is the critical point. We believe absolutely that the price is outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. And we are advocating with the United States Congress, with the American Medical Association, with Medicare and others to get this approved, because it is so critically important that it be available to the masses of people who need this treatment.
And accessible financially.
And accessible financially. That's correct.
Okay. Dr. Thorstensen, thoughts on it? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, thanks. Let me start by just highlighting how important the Alzheimer's Association is as a partner in the discovery around Alzheimer's disease. And this is not something that was reached, a decision that was reached lightly. I was involved in some of these conversations, and they talked to people that were for this approval and against this approval. And I really have to say, we have to start somewhere. The first drug needs to be first in class and not necessarily best in class. There was controversy, absolutely. And I understand those that are hesitant about this. But what does this drug do? It targets the beta amyloid, which is, by all accounts, the first step in a process that goes awry in Alzheimer's disease, the buildup of amyloid plaques, which by the time that you have clinical symptoms have basically saturated all over the brain and appears to trigger the next steps, the tau tangles and the inflammation and the oxidative stress, et cetera. This drug is incredibly effective in terms of removing amyloid. Regrettably, the effect size of even full clearance of amyloid at the stage of clinical symptoms is modest. But if you're talking about a 30 to 40% delay in progression of the disease, Is that worthwhile or is that not worthwhile? Some people say, not for this cost. Others say, no, that would be important to me. And I think that if you look at cancer, if you look at diabetes, if you look at heart disease, a 30 to 40% delay of worsening would be meaningful to many. And I think that the important thing here is that this is the first of multiple other treatments, some along the same lines, and others approaching the disease in a completely different way, but that target either the amyloid dysregulation, the excessive tau buildup, the neuroinflammation, et cetera, and we have to start somewhere. This is not a medication for everyone. It is not for all people with Alzheimer's disease. We have to be very thoughtful because it's expensive, it's complex, it's not without potential complications. But my own personal opinion is that this is something that ends up being discussed between the patient, their family, and their physician other medical provider.
And I've just got to jump in because we're out of time, Doctor. And sure. I just want to thank you for the expertise. That's Dr. Anton Thorstensen. Doctor, thank you for the expertise this hour. And
You're welcome.
Here with us in the studio, Teresa Galbier, the chapter executive for the Rochester and Finger Lakes chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Good luck to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And we'll see Maureen McGuire tomorrow morning. She's chair of the walk. Right here at Frontier Field. Starts at 10, registration at 9, alz.org. More online we'll link to. Thank you very much, Maureen, for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
More connections coming up.